This is Mintcast, a podcast by the Linux Mint community for all users of Linux. We record every other week on Sunday afternoons. Watch the Mintcast website for the schedule. The live stream information is at mintcast.org/livestream, and we are often in the Mintcast channel on irc.spotchat.org. If you see something you'd like to hear about on the podcast, send us email, mintcast@mintcast.org, or head on over to the Mintcast subreddit. You can also post comments in the forums on linuxmint.com. We'll try and check them out as well. So let us know what you'd like to hear. And now, on to the Mintcast.
Hello and welcome to Mintcast episode 280. This is Isaac and Rob, and we're recording live on Sunday, January 21st, 2018. And this week we have a very special guest. This entire time I've been trying not to be so giddy like a little girl, but welcome to the show, Rand Levy, the host of Malicious Life Podcast. I'm stumbling for words now. So.
Woohoo! You're starstruck. I can just see.
Thank you. Hi, Isaac. Hi, Rob.
Well, welcome, Rand. This is really a treat for us, I have to say. You don't know how regularly we have been nattering on about Malicious Life since, I think you first discovered it and then got me onto it. And it just seems like about every podcast we got, oh, did you hear this one? Oh, yeah, I'm almost caught up now. So
thanks.
This is delightful to have you on. We really enjoy the work you do.
Thank you. Thank you. It's great fun to do the show.
Well, good. Okay. So I guess we have, so IRC is just silent, right? Everybody's quiet. Highlander comments in there. Seems to be starstruck as well. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. They're never like that for us, right? They just chatter on. Half the time they're talking about the weather or football or something. I don't think they even listen to us in there. They just show up. Anyway. But I digress already. We have a list of questions to keep us on track. And if you've listened to this podcast much, you'll understand that us being on track is an extremely unlikely thing to happen. But we'll get started. So, you know, Isaac, something we've never done on the podcast is we have never introduced ourselves particularly. We just sort of start talking as if, well,
as everybody knows
who we are. So, of course, Rand has no idea who we are. So maybe it would be good if, and then this is just an excuse for me to talk, I know. But if we talked just for a minute about who we are, and then, Rand, I'll get you to do the same thing. So let me start and tell you what I'm thinking of what we're doing. My name's Rob, and as I said when I first started doing this podcast, I've been a Linux fooler arounder with for a long time, since I think my first experience with Linux was installing Slackware from, I think it had to be like 100 floppy disk drives that you had to do it in those days, and it was on some old machine that one of my kids had given up on. So I've been playing with Linux since the 90s, sometime in the 90s. And I've been a computer nut since I was in university in the 70s. So that's dating myself a long way. I was one of those nerds that walked around campus with a big cardboard box full of punch card tape or punch cards. So this has been a lifelong love affair with computers. And operating systems and most technical stuff. I'm a chemical engineer by training, and so I spend all day in front of a screen, but not on Linux, of course, because in the corporate world, most everybody runs Windows. So I do Windows on my day job, and Linux most of the rest of the time, although I've got a Windows box that I use for gaming. So that's kind of more than you wanted to know about me. Isaac, tell us all of the deep, dark secrets, at least two things you've never told anybody before. How about that?
Oh, gosh. I've done a polygraph before, so I'm pretty sure it's all out there. Anyway, I'm Isaac Carter. Let me think. When I was a wild child, definitely growing up, I've always been, I guess, smart, but I just never had a care for myself or life. I got really heavy into drugs, which got me the Marines. And then the Marines were like, they took my head out of my butt and put it back on my shoulders. And then after the Marines, I started going back to school again. And from there, I had a cousin who had always done programming. And I kind of always was savvy with computers. And then from that, I kind of got more into, after the Marines, more into, I'd say, programming and networking. But between the two of those, I found networking to be a lot of fun, but much easier than programming. And I just kind of fell more into programming, I guess, because of the challenge it offered. And so then I graduated probably about 2010. And since then, I've been working as a programmer since then. I'd say my first run-in with Linux was around that same time period. I was playing with Kubuntu, I believe is what it was at that point in time. But it wasn't until about 2012-ish that I got heavy into Linux Mint. And from there, everything just really took off. So I'm just a programmer by trade. I've done several jobs for the private sector and for government contractors. I'd say my bread and butter is Java, but I really am into JavaScript now, about every flavor of it. And that's what I consider to be my sword now. But since then, I've just been doing a lot more with Linux, the podcast. I've been lately getting heavy into GNU stuff. What else is there out there?
Wait, he's a little bit of a fanatic when it comes to that GNU stuff.
I've been slowly reading. I mean, it's funny when we first started talking to Rand. I've been reading more of Stallman's got a good book out there that I alluded to a little bit in the last podcast about Free Society, Free Software. I've been reading more of it, and I've really know where he's coming from now, and it's made me ask a few questions to myself and the Linux community in general in my head, but stuff will bring up at another point in time. But that's really, I guess, everything about me, and Rob's said it before, I just kind of go and put my mind to something, and that's about it. I go and do it. So,
so Rand, tell us a little bit about where you've come from and how you've gotten to where you are now.
Sure. So, I had the honor to interview Stallman, just to, as a footnote to what you just said.
Now you're just and showing off. That's
maybe
what
we'll have
now.
A chance to talk about it. It was a very interesting conversation I had with him. So, my name is Rand Levy. You might hear from my accent that I'm from Israel. So now it's 10:30 p.m. now in Israel. And I'll say a few words about Malicious Life, since I guess most of the audience might not be aware of it. Malicious Life is a podcast about the history of cybersecurity. We talk mostly it's deep research and stories from the farther reaches of cybersecurity, even as far back as the 1960s up to today. I mean, the most modern APT attacks and everything that happens right now. So that's Malicious Life in a nutshell. And I've been a podcaster since 2007. I'm probably one of the first podcasters in Israel. My podcast in Hebrew, which is called Making History, about science and technology, is currently the most listened to podcast in Israel, the most successful podcast. Probably would be considered rather small in U.S. scale, but in Israel it's quite big. It's something in the vicinity of 100,000 listeners. And I'm an electronics engineer by trade. That's what I did for a long, long time. Turned developer somewhere in the middle of my career. Worked mostly on Python and FPGAs. I don't know if you guys, do you know what an FPGA is? Nobody knows. Don't feel too bad about it. No,
it's a programmable.
Exactly. Yeah.
Programmable gate array. It's exactly. A hardware modifiable chip.
It's an amazing invention. I liked it very much. It's like it's programming hardware. It's really.
But nobody uses them for anything.
It is very. Yeah, it's a very niche kind of technology. But if you're a tinker like myself and you like to do everything from, from assembler up to operating systems, FPGAs there, because you can really build computers within chips. So I did that for a long, long time. And of course, Bitcoin. Yeah, one of our guys in our IRC.
Yeah, Mark really Turtle create, points out Bitcoin. Yeah.
Yeah, you can create great miners with FPGAs. I am an author about the history of science and technology, and I wrote a book called, it would probably translate to English, Battle of Minds. That's a rough translation, and it's about the history of cybersecurity. So that's me in a nutshell.
So is that book available in English or in any other languages that people could get hold of?
Not yet, sadly. I'm planning on translating it, but there's lots of copyright issues to circumvent somehow.
Oh, really? Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. So this is a Linux podcast, and so we have to ask, what has been your experience with Linux? Are you a regular Linux user? Do you keep Linux around for testing, or do you just ignore it altogether? Any interesting Linux stories? All kinds of questions like that.
Yeah, I'm a very long. I mean, I've been using Linux for a long time. Actually, my office computer, since I run my own. I mean, I have a company. I have a podcasting production company. Most of the office computers are Ubuntu, and we use it all the time. And as a developer, of course, my preferred development environment was always Linux. It's much preferable to Windows, I think. So I do know Linux quite well. I usually use Ubuntu, but I had on occasions I used Lubuntu. It's a kind of a flavor of Ubuntu.
Yep.
Actually, I had I have now a kind of a very old laptop somewhere around in the house, and it's just to give you a sense. I bought it 13 years ago. It's an Intel. It uses an Intel Atom processor.
Yeah.
Which is very, very weak. I mean, that's almost a calculator by today's standards.
Yeah.
And it originally the laptop ran Windows XP. And of course, after half a year or so, it became totally unresponsive.
Yep.
So I wiped it out, installed Lubuntu, and it's been running ever since, and it's been running like magic. That's the power of Linux.
that's a cool story, yeah. Are famous at least to us as a security person. And so I'm interested to explore with you a little bit the intersection of Linux and security. We hear all the time, and actually a lot of the distro producers claim for a long time that there are no Linux viruses. You don't need to worry about viruses on Linux. This is a Windows problem. Most Linux users that I know, myself included, don't routinely run virus scanning software on their machines. And so I guess I wanted to talk a little bit about that. Is this just craziness? Are we kidding ourselves? What advice really can, what should regular Linux users be doing about cybersecurity?
It's not craziness. I mean, objectively, there are much, much, much less viruses and malware for Linux than Windows. But it's important, I think, to understand why. It's not because Linux is somehow, unique or better in any sense, in cybersecurity sense, to other operating systems. It's mostly has to do with Linux not being the low-hanging fruit of cybersecurity. When you're talking about the number of users worldwide, there's no doubt that Windows has a great percentage of the users. So if you are a hacker or a malware writer creating a malware for, the mass, trying to get as many computers as you can, which is often the case, it doesn't make any sense to create malware for Linux. So that's the main reason why you don't see too many viruses and worms for Linux.
For Lubuntu, yeah, running under your Atom.
Exactly, exactly. Now, there are other reasons as well. I mean, you guys probably know most Linux users are sophisticated users, right? My grandpa and grandma won't use Linux. They'll use Windows, if they can at all. So yeah. These users are sophisticated. They'll see something wrong. Many of them will be able to recognize it. Also, there are traditions, you can help call them, perhaps, in the Linux or even the Unix world, that kind of enable security by design, like packaging, package managers, like apt-get and yum and npm. Sorry. So these kinds of software repositories lessen the chance that you'll download something malicious. So that's the main reason that Linux is relatively clear of malware. But we have seen many, many Linux worms and viruses over the years. The first ones came out really in the early 1990s, not long after Linux began to be popular. So the average Linux users, really, they don't have to be afraid of regular malware. But, and it's a big but, Linux is vulnerable. For every kind of attack you can imagine that Windows is vulnerable to, Linux is vulnerable as well, which means that if you are running a computer, which is a great potential target for a targeted attack, like maybe you have a company and your computers are, Linux computers running all the, accounting information, whatever, or industrial computers, I mean, everything that is considered to be a worthwhile attack for an attacker that really is targeting you, you're as vulnerable as any other computer, and you're not different from Windows or Raspberry Pi or the iPhone or whatever.
Let me unpack that just a minute, Rand. Just from the point of view of numbers of machines or values of machines that are available, I would have guessed, so there are probably many more Windows computers in existence than any other kind of computer, but most of the internet runs on Linux boxes. And so that would seem to be a pretty significant target that would make it worth it for somebody to develop a virus or develop malware that was specifically targeted at web server type installations of Linux. And yet you don't hear a lot about that. Mostly what we hear about are Windows desktop viruses.
You're right. And I think it all boils down to motivation. Most of the virus authors or malware authors, their main motivation is financial, right? You want to make money.
Right.
Back in the 1990s and the early 2000s, we had lots of hackers who wrote viruses and worms for fun, for vandalism, and you saw quite a lot of worms for web servers back then. Now it's not so common because most authors want to make money, and you won't get any money by infecting infrastructure web servers. Most of the money is in hijacking computers, using them for DDoS attacks, hijacking or using computers for ransomware, locking your documents. Right now, that's the fashionable thing to do for malware authors. So it's just a matter of motivation. If someone has good motivation to hack into or in some way sabotage the web infrastructure, then probably these machines would be as able to be threatened than as almost any other computer, I would guess.
So it's a matter of you can't monetize your malware if you're going after sort of the Linux infrastructure that's on the internet. Either you're dealing with, I don't know who the owner of that is, so I don't know who to tell me they have to pay me money, or I'm dealing with somebody that's a little bit beefier in terms of their resistance to blackmail and coercion than the average desktop user would be.
Yeah, exactly right. And I think that now is a good time to make the distinction between, financial hackers and virus authors who want to make money, and state-sponsored actors in the world of cybersecurity. Because, I mean, the guys who want to make money, they'll target the lowest hanging fruits. And these are probably Windows computers right now, or Android phones, or whatever. But when you're talking about nation state actors, governments who want to attack other governments mostly, they are probably looking into ways to sabotage the internet infrastructure for these countries. So I would guess that these kinds of actors have cyber weapons dedicated to attacking, to hacking into servers, etc. It wouldn't be too much of a guess, I guess.
Well, it's you bring up a good point there too, Rand. I mean, programmers by trade or by default are lazy. So if you're looking to make money and you're a hacker, you're not going to be, why do I want to spend the time trying to hack a Linux system, like you said, Rob, that's hardened up, when I can just go and DDoS the crap out of them and then get my money from that instead of trying to route a much harder way through all that. So you also brought up another good point, Rand. I didn't think about this. I always looked at it. Why Linux was never targeted was merely the number game that you brought up. Most computers run Windows. But why target an OS when the community is nothing but tinkerers? That never occurred to me until you brought that up. Because just earlier today, I was updating a computer and I was on the man pages, purging stuff and reading this and that. And I realized if you're going to hack my computer, it'd be like, why? You're going to be like constantly in a... you're eventually going to beat me, I'm sure, but in a battle back and forth of me tinkering with this, and there's no reason to go down that road when you could just go do Windows, which, like you said, like my grandparents, too, are running Windows by default. They're not tinkerers at all. They don't care how they get their updates. They just accept their updates. When I'm over here, Rob, you know how we are with Linux Mint, setting the levels of updates we'll accept, double-checking the updates, changing mirrors. We're doing everything we can. It never hit me that that's a world of tinkerers. Like, don't mess with them. You know, you're going to be in over your head real quickly. Just go and target the community that doesn't care about any of that stuff.
Yeah, you're completely right. And I think for the average Linux user, really there's no much sense in using antivirus software or whatever. To tell the truth, I even on Windows, I've been around malware for so long, I don't care that much for what antivirus software I use, because I'm saying to myself, if I get hacked, it's probably not the antivirus that's going to help me. It would put probably something that would be so sophisticated that it would go past my antivirus so fast, I would never have a chance to do anything about it. So my advice to almost every user is just back up everything and be ready to format your computer and start over again. Don't put too much of your luck on antivirus software, etc. If you're a sophisticated user, just trust your instincts and back up.
So I can't bring myself to give up on the intrinsic betterness of Linux. And I guess maybe that's an old idea. There was a time that Linux was, by its design and architecture, a more secure environment to do computing in, certainly than Windows was. Probably never was more secure than Mac, because Mac OS came from OpenBSD, but Linux just feels like you ought to be more secure somehow there than you would be on a Linux box. All else being kind of everything else taken out of the equation, just the operating system is more secure. Is that a myth?
I think it is. If there's anything that experience has taught us, is that there is no such thing as a totally secure software. There hasn't been, never such a thing. It's a myth. I think now that even the way people in cybersecurity have learned to view the basic problem of cybersecurity is that there's no such thing as total protection. And everybody now is talking about defense in layers.
Right.
Trying to I mean, assuming the attacker penetrated this layer, we're going to maybe defend on that layer. And if that fails, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Linux as software, it's probably a great software. I mean, I'm not one of the core developers of Linux, so I can't say anything out of my own experience, but the guys who maintain Linux are probably the best professionals in the world. Having said that, they do make mistakes. And in a system so complicated, we're talking about how many lines of code now in the Linux
millions
kernel.
Millions,
exactly.
Yeah,
it's almost unbelievable that there won't be like a billion holes there. They're bound to be if you're looking for them. Maybe not the easiest holes. Like you can maybe like, you know, software on Windows, you can run like thousands and thousands of different softwares, and each one of them can have some sort of a vulnerability, and you can use that. Maybe there's the attack surface on Linux is a bit smaller, not so many computer programs available than in the Windows world. But still, let's be realistic. Linux is so complex. If a dedicated attacker, and I guess that nation state actors are very dedicated and they're pouring a lot of money into research, they'll find those vulnerabilities. And they'll use it only when they need to. So the average user won't ever know anything about it. It will be completely silent in the background. You'll never know you'll be hacked. That's the sad truth, probably.
Yeah, it's, you know, there was a story came out just, it's probably a year ago now, about a bug that had been sitting in some low-level Linux library that had been there for 15 years. And they virtually every Linux installation was susceptible to this thing. So yeah, there's bound to be more of those floating around, I guess.
That's because there's only one person maintaining Linux. It's Linus. All your pull requests go through him, and then he will say yes or no, or cuss you out accordingly. And that's how Linux is maintained.
So, I'll try and grow up and just become an adult and give up on my fantasies.
got me laughing her off of that one. I'm going to get off these questions we have laid out for Rand real quick. And I want to ask you a couple questions, Rand, about your podcast, Malicious Life, because the way I found it, I just found it when I was going through latest podcast, and I started listening to it, and I told Rob, hey, you need to check this podcast out because it's not it's not something like what we do, or another podcast where he's just talking about security news. Like, this is literally stories he is talking about and some really serious information. So the question I guess I would like to know is what is the amount of homework you have to do to get these podcasts to sound the way you do? Because you do such a great job of narrating them. And how do you get some of this information? Because it is amazing the level of detail and homework you have done for some of these. And that it's just mind-boggling. And I think the reason I just clinged on to Malicious Life is because when I was going through college, the areas that Malicious Life covers are always been the areas I've been so interested in with programming, because it's like the game behind the game. It's almost like Westworld. Like, there's that maze of what's going on in the background, and I've always been infatuated with that stuff. And you perfectly hit on all that stuff except for one, which I pray to God you cover one day. And that's that Kaficker worm that I did a report on around like the time it blew up in 2008 or so. But the stuff you cover is amazing. So could you just walk us down how you decide what to do and the level of homework you put into one of your episodes.
I think he makes all this stuff up, Isaac. It's none of it's true. Right? It's all made up.
You caught me there.
He's literally reading a Wikipedia entry. That's all he's doing. Right, it's perfectly done.
It's a heavily researched production. I guess it's somewhere in the vicinity of 50 to 80 hours of research and writing that goes to.
So is this just you? Is there a team? Because, I mean, Midcast is literally robbing me, you know, and that is it.
Mm-hmm. No, it's a team. I started as an indie podcaster, and after 7 years, I managed to actually to create a company and recruit people and get an investment going on. And now we are six people in full work and about 20 freelancers. But on that specific show, specifically Malicious Life, it's basically three people. It's me, it's another writer, a guy named Nate, who's a researcher and writer as well, and Eliad, which is responsible for mostly marketing. He's from Cyber Reason, which sponsors the podcast. And to tell the truth, I think that it's the way I'm thinking about stuff is that I write about what's interesting for me personally. If it's interesting to me and I love the subject and I love the topic and I'm very much in love with cybersecurity, I can read about it and research about it forever, just for the fun of it. And for me, sitting 40 hours and reading papers and reading history books about cybersecurity, it's something that I would probably do even if I didn't have Malicious Life. So I just read a lot and I go over lots and lots of material. And I mean, being an author for like almost like 20, 25 years now, I'm very, very experienced in the process of researching and writing down the important bits. And, you know, I have a very sophisticated or very an organized system of collecting information and creating like a rough cut of what I want to say. And the actual process of actually writing the episode, because everything starts with writing, me being a writer and then a podcaster, it's rather easy. The research takes almost all the time. The actual writing takes probably 3-4 hours per episode. But it's mostly a technical thing. Once you have all that information digested and gathered in a kind of organized manner, it's rather easy. And as an author, I'm always looking for the story angle, the angle of who's the main character, what's the narrative. It comes naturally to me. I mean, I come from the writing world. And in the writing world, it's all about the narrative. You don't try to convey information, mostly. You're trying to tell a good story. In my case, it's just real stories, which even makes it much more fun. But basically, if you're telling a good story and you're filling in all the little details with what's really happening, the result is great fun.
That's the thing that struck me about the series that you did on Stuxnet. You know, that I work with control systems in my day job, and so I had heard of Stuxnet and knew bits and pieces of it, of the story. But the thing that made those episodes of Malicious Life so compelling was the way that it came across as a story, that you heard about the people, that they were, what they were doing, and then there'd be this neat little sort of divergence off into the arcane technical details of what they did. And then we'd be back to the story again. So, that makes the technical part of the podcast, more easily absorbed, I think.
That's, I think, one of the things that I've learned over time, mostly by writing the podcast, but also by writing books, is that if you're trying to explain highly technical material, like when you're talking about how malware works, etc., you first of all need to create the curiosity with the listener, with the reader. You have to give the listener or reader the reason to want to know that information. So when we're talking about Stuxnet, and for listeners who might not be aware of what we're talking about, Stuxnet was the worm that attacked a nuclear enrichment facility in Iran. It was, I think, 2010, if I remember correctly. It was one of the first, it was actually the first cyber weapon. Made lots of waves in the cyber security community. And when I'm talking about the Stuxnet worm, I usually start with a story. And then you hear about the effects of the worm. And over time, the listener kind of gets curious just by the story itself. How does this worm work? How was it able to do what you now just now told us? That's the point where I start getting technical, because then the listeners are really listening in. They want to know behind the scenes what's happening. And that's actually the fun part, because getting them to be interested and curious is the arty part of writing the story. Just explaining, I think, would be rather boring from the start. If you build a story, they'll want to know. That's my mantra.
What is something you've learned? I mean, what's something that's blown your mind since doing the podcast that you're like, whoa, I didn't know this from all these years of being a security researcher?
Tough question. so many things. What would be the most something that blew my mind? I think that when I started getting into ransomware and the whole financial background to malware and the malware industry, that's where it really became very, very interesting to me, because I came to malware from the more technical sides, being a programmer, being a designer. I was interested in how malware works. But actually, malware is just a tool for a very, it's a very diverse world of black markets and underground gangs of organized crime. And if you look at malware, just in the terms of how it pushes the world of economics around us, it gets so much interesting. Just give you a small example. You know those spam emails who pretend to be from like Nigerian princes?
Oh, yeah.
You know, the Nigerian prince scam?
I've talked to that guy several times. I'd send him my bank account stuff. He's going to put some money in there. I'm going to make a fortune out of that.
And he's not returning your calls for some reason.
No, not anymore. At first he did for quite a bit, but something's happened. I'll have to go over and see if I can get in hold of him.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the oldest scams in the book, probably. It's a very, if you're looking for the history of crime in general, you'll see these kinds of variations on the scam, even going back to the 16th century, right? Way before computers. But anyway, you'll see sometimes that the emails that you're getting are kind of very easily to notice that it's a scam. Like, you'd have to be a complete buffoon to fall for that scam, right? Sometimes it's like mistakes in spelling and grammar, and it seems so amateurish. And there are actually economists looking at that problem or that scam from the angle of maximizing the return of investments from the scammers. And they're saying, if you were a scammer and you're sending like millions and millions of scam emails, if you did a good job, you'll get only 1, 2, maybe 5 return emails, and those will be perfect victims. That's the best outcome you can hope for. What's the worst outcome? That you'll get hundreds and thousands of emails, right? I mean, from people, and then you'll be swamped, and then you'll have to work hard for your money, which is something that these guys don't want, right? They want to, they're lazy. The spammers are, the hackers are lazy. So the reason why those scam emails are so poorly created is probably because you'd have to be a complete buffoon, or aka the perfect victim, to fall for those scam mails.
So it's a filtering mechanism.
Exactly.
It's filtering out the people who are not going to pay me money anyway.
Exactly. You just
it's
have
like the
to
lottery.
Think about it as an economist who's trying to optimize a problem in finance, right? That's it. It's fun, yeah.
Oh, that is perfect, yeah. So here's another question that's not on our list. We're off script already.
Hey, that's what we do here, man.
But you know, your comments about malware and economics make me think something like, well, cryptocurrency has got to be just a perfect storm of a disaster then. That's just all of the wrong stuff happening together. Is that a hugely dangerous bad thing, or is this the salvation to all of our malware problems?
No, sorry, I missed that first part of the question again.
The notion of cryptocurrency, things like Bitcoin, is that just a perfect storm of a disaster, or is that going to be somehow much better at preventing malware somehow?
No, it's not going to prevent malware. If anything, the rise of ransomware in the last couple of years is directly credited to the rise of Bitcoin. Because up till Bitcoin, the reason why people, hackers didn't use ransomware is because that they had great difficulty in getting their victims to pay them money in untraceable ways. Basically, money lived trails behind, and if I would send you $300 to your bank account, then the police can just go ahead and check your bank account to see who you are. So that was the reason why ransomware never caught in the early 2000s and even up until the last 2-3 years. With Bitcoin being not a completely anonymous way to pay money, but almost anonymous, now there's a perfect mechanism for victims to pay the ransoms. And because of that, you can see the storm of ransomware rising, and every year you get bigger and bigger ransomwares WannaCry and Petya and whatever. So if anything, probably crypto coins are going to make malware much, much worse, not better.
So are crypto coins, is that cryptocurrency itself open to zero-day exploits and that kind of why don't these threat actors just go after the cryptocurrency itself? It seems like it would be a huge target now.
No, they do. If you follow, for example, Ethereum, one of the largest crypto coins out there, in the early days of Ethereum, there was a big vulnerability in one of those contracts. Ethereum is based on contracts. Yeah. And actually, a hacker who used that vulnerability, exploited that vulnerability, got away with, I think it was $30 million worth of Ethereum. So yeah, people if there's money there and it's computer-based, people would probably find a way to exploit that, yeah.
Yeah, there was the Mt. Gox hack that really kicked Bitcoin in the stomach early on. It kind of stopped it from taking off. I remember that one.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, I had a Mt. Gox account. The thing that saved me, I didn't have any Bitcoins in it. So, yeah. Hack away, actually, guys.
Actually, I was one of the first vendors in Israel to accept Bitcoins back in 2010, even. I would sell episodes of my podcast and books for Bitcoin. But sadly, I sold most of it when it was worth something like $500. And I felt really good about myself, wow, I made $500.
That's
now
right.
I feel very foolish.
Well, yeah. So
that's why authors never get rich. We don't have the right instincts.
So you're just early. If you just wait a little bit, you will look like an absolute genius because you got $500 out of it.
Exactly.
Instead of zero.
Yeah. So what exactly is your take, Rand, on the future of, say, IT security and everything you've been doing your homework on? What do you foresee coming in, the near future?
Lots and lots of interesting things. Cybersecurity is such a dynamic field. It's really a battle of minds, constantly evolving. The biggest threat right now is with nation-state actors, because when we're talking about hackers and malware authors who are independent, they're kind of limited in the damage they can do. They can cause great damage, but systems are getting more sophisticated. Back in the 1990s, you might remember, even the 1980s, every teenager could create like a virus which would spread around the world, infecting hundreds of thousands of computers. Nowadays, it's much tougher. Systems are much more secure, and we have updates online for everything. And it's tougher for like independent hackers to create like very, very sophisticated malware. But now in the last 10 years or so, when nation state actors are pouring millions and millions of dollars, and they have teams like every one of the superpowers now have, you know, armies of hackers, mostly some of them are like enlisted personnel. Some of them are like, you know, part civilian, part soldiers, but they pour a lot of money, a lot of manpower, a lot of smart brains into trying to hack stuff. And I think the most dangerous thing that we already can see now starting is the leakage of cyber weapons into the civilian world. For example, WannaCry, if you remember from like a year and a half ago, a year ago, it was based on a vulnerability, on an exploit called Eternal Blue that leaked from the NSA. You remember that?
Yes.
That's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
And that was a demonstration of how potentially dangerous these cyber weapons can be, because Eternal Blue was developed by a team of brilliant computer scientists, probably. And it was very successful, and thus WannaCry was very successful. And by their nature, these cyber weapons are not like, say, nuclear bombs, right? Nuclear bombs you can store in a remote location somewhere, never use them until you need them, right? But when it comes to cyber weapons, you need to use them, because if you don't use them now, within a year they'll be worthless. You need to use them. Unless you want to just develop them and then leave them hanging. But nobody wants to do that. You want to invest your money in something that works. So if you put those weapons and exploits and all that smart stuff into malware, such as Stuxnet, for example, and then that malware gets discovered, much like Stuxnet was discovered, all those exploits and technology has now leaked into the wrong hands of hackers and criminals. That's a very, very hard problem to solve, and I can't see how they will solve it in the next few near future. So you'll see much more sophisticated weapons leaking into criminal hands.
Not just that, but I mean, the amount of money and time and knowledge that was dumped into Stuxnet, so when it gets discovered and patched up, that's gone. That's not coming back, you know. And it's just,
well, that's the best case is it's not coming back.
No, but I mean that time, if you're that country, or if I say it's my company, it's like I just spent how much money on something that's now gone. Like that ship is sailed. It's not coming back to dock. Right. But that's what I see Rand's getting at. But now, as far as like the next level down, like just like we said, a financial hacker of some sort, would, that's still game for them, but no longer game for you. So it's now you have to up your game, but also the world has to contend with both of those, you know. So
exactly right. And there's no real easy solution for that kind of leakage, and we'll probably see much more of these occasions. Yes. And remember that Stuxnet, by the way, used four separate 0 days vulnerabilities.
Yep.
Right.
In the same worm, which was kind of amazing because each one of them costs like $100,000 in the market. And when Stuxnet leaked, all of a sudden the criminals had they were served four fresh 0 days to use for nothing. So
does the general computing infrastructure somehow just evolve to immunize itself against kind of all of those easy things, all the known things that have been used and exposed, just sort of get absorbed in the DNA of the infrastructure, and now it's immune to them? Or are those things going to keep popping up over and over again in different forms, do you think?
Interesting question, because it kind of brings me to biology. I tend to think about the world of cybersecurity, the environment, the cyber environment, much in the way that I view nature as a whole. Because think about the natural environment around us. We have organisms, humans, animals, whatever, and we have viruses and parasites and bacteria. And there's a constant battle between the host and the attackers. And over time, there's a kind of equilibrium. The bacteria or virus develops some sort of a new trick, biological trick, to harm the host, and then the host either dies off or mutates to fight that new threat. And over time, there's an equilibrium. It's built into the natural system. I think that what we are seeing in the world of cybersecurity is much the same. People who or systems who are particularly vulnerable will be, for example, Flash, right? Flash was kind of it was kicked out of most computers because it was such a vulnerable framework. And it had so many vulnerabilities so that people just decided not to use it anymore. It was because of, think of Apple the first, but Flash disappeared rather quickly. So over time, I think that there is now and there will be some sort of an equilibrium that systems are getting harder, getting hardened, and user being more sophisticated. And of course, malware is getting sophisticated all the time. Having said that, there's kind of an interesting phenomena of what I like to call the internet background creation. Think about machines, old Windows XP machines sitting in closets, nobody using them. I saw not too long ago a picture of a Commodore computer from the early 1990s, I guess it was, being used in a garage in Romania somewhere. Like,
wow.
The internet is filled with old computers who will never be completely updated, if ever. And they are probably infected with, viruses, malware. And they are kind of sending packets, trying to get, all the worms still living, all the malware still living, trying to infect other computers. So there's always a kind of a background radiation of old viruses still floating around. It's very interesting to think about it.
You're right, because WannaCry did so well or took off so much because of the XP computers that were running, I think, in the UK's health industry. Most of their hospitals, I think, was what got targeted because they just couldn't patch these or replace them or update them, with a new or later, OS. So you're right. It's these old computers that were always still going to be, XP is still out there, still going. And I didn't realize Commodores were still out there, still going, but that shouldn't surprise me. And also with phones, I'm still using a OnePlus One. I think they quit issuing out updates for that. But with phones nowadays, you just cannot keep up with the updates they're pushing or without getting a brand new phone. And that's just not financially feasible for everyone. So, phones are even worse in the sense of running older OSs than computers, most of the time, it seems like.
Of course. And IoT devices. That's the new frontier for malware. Nobody's going to update their DVD, right? That's not something that we would probably do. These machines are going to stay vulnerable practically forever in terms of electronics.
As long as they exist, certainly, they're going to be, many of them not smart enough to be updated easily. And so the vulnerability will exist as long as the device exists.
Yeah. And actually, Bill in the IRC channel is right. When you're talking about, for example, hospitals, we shouldn't probably judge them too harshly for not updating their machines, because I wouldn't update my machine if I thought that update can kill a patient, right? Yeah. You'd have to be very, very careful. And that's the game we have to play. That's the playing field for cybersecurity.
Yeah, a lot of the medical and food industries are driven by standards that are in place specifically to stop change, because what they figured out is every time you change something, you introduce the possibility of breaking it and causing problems with the medicine or with the food or whatever. So there are huge procedures around change. But that's just exactly opposite to the environment and the landscape of cybersecurity, which is a constantly changing thing. You're constantly after modifying things to keep them safe. And so those, it's hard to imagine how those two worlds will ever converge on something that works.
Yeah, that's right. And I think these organizations usually tend to pursue a solution which kind of separates them from the internet, because they know that unless there's a kind of an air gap between the device and the internet, it's just a matter of time until you're pwned, right? So trying to create an air gap is a non-perfect solution, but it is a solution.
Yeah, I was going to say, is that really even possible? Can, you know, because in the control systems world, where Stuxnet lives, that's kind of been the mantra for some time. Is they, people will say, oh, okay, well, I want to take this critical infrastructure and I want to separate it from the internet. I want to air gap it. And as soon as you do that, you very quickly learn that, well, you can't actually really do that. You can, but boy, stuff really doesn't work very well when you do.
Yeah, I had the same experience I worked as an engineer in a sort of a security company that created sensitive electronics. And of course, our system was air-gapped from the internet. But you rather quickly find out that if you're really, really separated from the internet, you can't work. Basically, right. If
you can't do anything, yeah.
If you can't surf Stack Overflow, there's no software.
How do you ever learn anything?
Yeah. How will I ever program? It's impossible.
Exactly. As a programmer, I had to kind of, I had no choice but to download the entirety of Stack Overflow into the internal network and kind of build a software front end to query the database for programmers to use. But it's not really a long range solution. So yes, it is. You can't really, really separate systems. But when you're talking about, for example, industrial systems, you can try, for example, make some information channels unidirectional. For example, I mean, you can perhaps have information flowing in it, but not going backwards, which kind of prevents attackers from learning what's happening inside the system. It could be useful. So there are some strategies to try to mitigate these problems, but there's no such thing as a completely secure system. There's no such thing.
A lot of those things were in place in the Stuxnet story as well, and what defeated them all was the deep insider knowledge that the attacker had of the environment that they were trying to get into. And,
yes,
and that seems to just step around. The best security you could put in place, if there's an inside mole who's revealing that, then you're pretty much scuppered often.
Yes, I think that's the biggest lesson that Stuxnet taught the cybersecurity community. There was the notion before Stuxnet that if you put the right set of tools, the right, you know, anti-malware software, the right firewalls, whatever, you can keep your system secure. But Stuxnet, as a cyber weapon, it showed us, yeah, that if the actor who's trying to, the attacker, is motivated enough and willing to invest as much money and resources as needed to penetrate the system, you're hopeless. It can always be hacked. And, of course, that's what happened with Stuxnet, right?
Right.
According to the news reports, it was the work of Israeli intelligence and the NSA. And, of course, these two parties have large resources.
Lots of money.
And, of course, yeah, they have also the information that they needed. They've got spies inside Iran. They knew exactly, how did one of the guests on the show said, they knew what toppings head of security likes on his pizza. In the Iranian nuclear facility. So when you have that kind of resources, you can't do really anything. But on the bright side, you can't expect any actor to have those kinds of resources for every target. You can do that for one nuclear facility, two nuclear facilities, one power plant, 10 power plants. the U.S. have, from what I've learned, probably some in the vicinity of 3,000 power plants. You can't hack all of them with all those resources. Mm-hmm. So there's some kind of protection in terms of if you try to make it hard enough to hack your system, the hackers will try an easier system, right? That's one sort of defense. Yeah.
I send all the I make my yard, my lawn into a toxic waste dump so that all of the insects go to my neighbors. that kind of an approach. Yeah.
Well, there was a I think Countdown to Zero Day. It was a book about Stuxnet, and they were saying that I can't remember which side of the fence it was, but when they discovered that the worm wasn't going to work or had been discovered, they're like, you know, screw it, just shoot them. I was like, Lord have mercy. You know, I was like, and that's really what they started doing, you know, and I was like, this is crazy. Just like, all right, we tried that. That's over. Now let's just, like you said, let's go do something easier that we know how this works.
Yeah.
So, Rand, you are a security researcher. I'd love to know your perspective and what you first thought of when you heard about the Meltdown and Spectra worms or viruses, wherever they might be, that hit the scene. I think they're just completely incompetent on IBM's part, is what it sounds like, or they willingly knew and just said, we need faster processors, that's that. So what did you think when you read about it, and I guess your whole mindset on that?
First of all, I'm not a security researcher per se, right? I'm an author, I'm a commentator, I'm an engineer, so I'm kind of familiar with lots of the ideas, but I'm not actively researching malware, etc. It's not my field of expertise. So, for example, I could probably explain, if I looked deeply into it, I could probably explain Meltdown and Spectre, but not right now. I couldn't be more, you know, in depth unless I really, really went and learned how it worked. But I know how it works in general. I'm very familiar with CPUs and how CPUs work, and we know that the vulnerability there is with the predictive branching, one of the oldest methods of speeding up CPUs used even in the early 1990s. And I don't think that it's the fault of any of the engineers who worked on it ever since. I mean, we're talking about 20 years and nobody discovered that specific vulnerability, because the way I understood those vulnerabilities, they are created because of the way the components inside a CPU work together. It's not a specific vulnerability in any component, but it's the way those computers communicate with each other. And those kinds of vulnerabilities are very, very difficult to locate. Since, remember, Intel's probably have like thousands of engineers working on each CPU at any given time. These are amazingly complex systems. So it would take some sort of a bird's eye view to have an understanding of how the entire mechanism works to discover that kind of vulnerability. I think it's not by chance that it was only discovered now, although it's been around ever since at least the early 1990s. And because it's in hardware, we can probably say for sure that it's a very big problem and it's not going away anytime soon. And it is something that will be probably exploited in the future. It will be very interesting to see how companies who maintain cloud environments work with these kinds of vulnerabilities, because really with the world of cloud computing, that's the biggest threat. No company wants to have its data stolen in a server somewhere over there. They have no control over, you know, somewhere in the cybersphere. It's a big problem, those two vulnerabilities.
Yeah, initially it seemed like it was kind of an Armageddon kind of event, that this was, you know, the computing world is ending because we're never going to be able to fix this. This is going to make everything else look like sandbox things. And as more information has come out, it seems less frightening now for most people. It seems, well, it's not that much of an issue for desktops. It's fixable. It mostly is going to be a performance hit on cloud-based infrastructure. Is that your read on it, or is this really an end of the world kind of thing that we need to worry about.
No, not the end of the world, thankfully. We've got some, I mean, we always can do sandwiches. Like, it's not high tech enough. We can always live on sandwiches.
That's true.
But no, it is, I think it is a serious problem because it's in hardware. If it was a software problem, you could always update. Hardware is of course, very hard to update. Nobody's going to change the billions upon billions of CPUs out there. And every kind of CPU practically has those vulnerabilities, right? Everything from ARMs to AMDs, probably Intel's CPUs, whatever. So these vulnerabilities are going to stay there for a very, very, very long time. Now, there are strategies to mitigate those problems, because to exploit a vulnerability, there are several ways you can exploit a vulnerability. Once the community understands the usual ways in which you can exploit a vulnerability, there are defenses. For example, an antivirus software could probably detect an algorithm which seems as if it's going to exploit that these kinds of vulnerabilities. Right. So it's not going to be the end of the world. Yet, from now on, every designer of, you know, software which is kind of low level, talking to the kernel, talking to the CPU, and there's something there that is very, very sensitive in terms of information, he's going to have to take into account these vulnerabilities or risk that the more sophisticated actors are going to attack those vulnerabilities. But it's not the end of the world. I mean, we are living with systems which are vulnerable in the most basic senses forever. A simple example is the email system that we are using every day. Email is vulnerable. We know how it's almost impossible to defend against social engineering attacks via email, because that's the nature of emails. It hasn't changed probably since the early 70s, right? And we are living with that situation, hoping that we can get by most of the time. So that will be probably the situation with these specific two vulnerabilities, I guess.
Yeah, so it's, in a sense, it's just moved, it's moved the war, if you will, just into another kind of landscape. You know, some of the first worms were exploited very simple things, and then as people got more sophisticated, it moved into different kinds of technologies. And so now we have hardware things that people are going to have to start worrying about. And there will be other things beyond this that nobody has thought of yet that are going to also show up. Yeah. So we have gone on. We had scheduled 30 minutes for this, and knowing
we did?
That, yeah.
You know. It's great fun.
So these are 30 Mintcast minutes. One of the best interview questions, I think that I've, this is stolen from several different interview places, that I love this question because it generates such interesting answers as, what are the things that we should have asked you? What are the things that, you know, if we had been better at asking questions, we would have come up with this question, do you think?
How much money would you like? What you got to pay me? But yeah. You should have asked me.
That's one. No, actually,
what have we missed in terms of Linux and cybersecurity and podcasting and all that stuff?
Not a lot, actually. I mean, we covered a lot of interesting angles. I think one of the most interesting aspects that is now kind of I'm interesting in is the rise of artificial intelligence and how it's going to affect the world of cybersecurity. We are seeing now in the past 5 years a dramatic rise in artificial intelligence applications because of deep learning, basically.
Yep.
And there's almost no doubt that we'll see applications of artificial intelligence penetrating the cybersecurity world. So how that turns out to be, and how one can hope to defend a system against intelligent software that is actively seeking to find vulnerabilities and can use social engineering tricks as well, is a very, very big challenge, I think. Everything that I'm reading about artificial intelligence tells me that we have very, very interesting years in front of us. And of course, the same thing goes to anti-malware systems, because of course those anti-malware systems are going to be also based on artificial intelligence. So we probably are going to see a future which kind of, I think, is science fiction-y in a kind of way. A future in which our intelligence systems are battling it out rather autonomously, trying to kind of weave defenses and attacks in imaginative ways and unexpected ways. And it would be very interesting to see how that technology kind of changes the playing field in cybersecurity.
So we're coming into a time in cybersecurity when we will understand neither the attack nor the defense, and nor will we understand how to build an attacker or a defender. So
exactly.
The AI is going to be, because one of the characteristics of these AI systems is their lack of transparencies. They're opaque in terms of their reasoning. They make decisions and you don't know, and there's no way to know why they decided in a particular way. So
exactly.
Boy, that's frightening to think that that is coming to cybersecurity, but of course it has to be, that once AIs like that exist, you can't but use them.
Of course. And I think that I kind of had a notion of this even 20 years ago. I served in the Israeli military in my 20s, and I was captain of a ship in the Israeli Navy. And even back then, when you talked about anti-ship missiles, these missiles became so sophisticated so fast that even as far back as the early 90s and 2000s, the defense systems had to be completely autonomous. Even back then, there was no
hope. Everything happened so fast.
Exactly.
That no human could. Yeah,
exactly. If there was a missile heading your way, you had no hope of human interaction being in the way. You just had to pray that your system was as intelligent and as smart as the missile coming towards you. And and I didn't feel that, especially when I started learning engineering, it kind of didn't make me so, I wasn't relaxed, let's say that.
Well, because you knew your system had been provided by a low-cost bidder.
Exactly, yeah. And actually, I had a period, even I flew in airplanes for a long time and I didn't have any problem. But once I learned engineering, I did start to have a problem. but it went away over time. I don't know if I'm smart or not, but...
Well, you're still here, so that says something for
yeah,
it, right?
Yeah, I try not to fly too much because it was built by the lowest bidder, yeah.
Before we let you go, Ran, I've had the luxury of emailing with Richard Stallman, and really his email was nothing more than, thanks for writing about GNU, but it's GNU/Linux, buddy. And I really want you to call it that from now on. And we had a little bit of a back and forth of just, you know, this, that, and the other. But you have recently interviewed him and said you as well look up to him, because I look up to him quite a bit. What were your thoughts, and how did you feel talking to him, and what's, you know, just your whole interaction with RMS?
First of all, yes, I look up to RMS. And for our listeners, maybe our younger listeners, he's the guy who started the free software movement. He's the author of the Emacs editor. He's like a mythical figure in the world of computers.
Yeah. He looks like a mythical figure. He,
exactly.
As well.
Absolutely,
he's the prototypical hacker, gray beard, superbly smart person, right? So he was a hero of mine ever since I was a kid. I wanted to be Richard Stallman. And of course, when I thought about creating an episode of the history of open source and free software, I contacted him and was very gracious in agreeing to be interviewed. But as you said, he had some conditions. And the first was rather easy, that I would always, I need to say always GNU/Linux, else there's no interview. But I could stand that. Yeah, I could follow that. And then he said, "You need to have the podcast episode be to kind of spread it over to the world to as an org
Oh
verbis.
Yeah, very
of
much
course.
Yep.
Because it's open source." And I said to him, "You know, I mean, it was over mail, still trying to negotiate the interview." And I said, "You know what? I have no problem using Og as well as MP3, but to tell you the truth, all my listeners, they don't know what Og is. Nobody will listen." So he says, "Out, you know what? Okay, no, you can use also MP3, although it's proprietary. It was back then, but your website should not use JavaScript." Now, that was too much for me. I said, "Richard, you've got to believe me. My website will not run without JavaScript. No website will run without JavaScript." So he agreed. But really, I'm joking. Joking aside, he's an awesome person. He's so much. It was so interesting talking to him and just getting to know his ideas. And actually, it was kind of even... It was a kind of a tough experience for me because, I mean, here I was talking to one of my idols, and he's the prototypical hacker, and he says he doesn't use technology no more. He doesn't have a smartphone. He hardly uses computers because he doesn't trust those proprietary software, and of course, he doesn't trust software vendors who don't use free software. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of weird because you see that guy is no longer relevant in the technological world of nowadays, but he has great points. He's absolutely right in saying that proprietary software is a big problem for us in the modern world. So he kind of made me realize that maybe, you know, putting too much trust into Apple, into Google, into Facebook is not a good idea. And ever since talking to him, I kind of leaned much more heavily into open source than I used to. That's the truth. And actually, while I was talking to him in the interview, I was using Skype because is... And he didn't know that. He thought I was calling over the phone. And he said something like, "You'd have to be an idiot to use Skype." And I was thinking to myself, is that a good time to say that I'm using Skype? No, it's not a good time.
Probably shouldn't bring this up now, yeah.
But he's right. He's got some great points. He's a very smart person, and we should probably listen to what he says. Else we are kind of jeopardizing our future as free citizens. And he's right.
Oh, yeah. When I emailed back and forth with him, it was one of the few times where I've had to write an email where I almost deleted all of it and thought, like, how do I go about writing this correctly? Because I don't want to offend this man. And I also would like to keep communicating with him. But when I was suggesting topics to write for the Free Software Foundation, it was just, he would send me back like, no, we're not promoting that. We're not going to talk about that. No. And I was just like, okay, sorry. I don't know what to do here. I'm kind of like, you know, up, you know, but I let him lead, but
he's so
right.
Ideological.
He's amazingly smart. Yeah. He's smart. His book, you really should read his book if you haven't. I luckily got it for Christmas, that free society, free software, because it's made me look at the difference between open source and this is all way too much to get into now, but like I was saying earlier, the difference between open source and free software. And I feel like he's right in the sense of why there is a division and why open source is good, but equally wrong, because I feel almost like, especially the way I've been with Linux, that promoting, hey, use Linux. But as long as you use Linux, it's cool. We'll worry about the bigger fight later, which is the right I should have to the software and whatnot. But we've kind of thrown those rights away that make free software what is free. And because of that, I think the proprietary world has gained like an upper hand to be like, oh, we'll use Linux, but we're not giving you the source code. I'm using Linux, dude, you know, so you should be happy with that. But you're right. As the world moves on, it's getting less. And I also think too, the world he came from and created for us will never be seen again, only because of how he was able to use Unix as a sounding board or jumping board to create what he needed to. Because nowadays, if say if I want to create like a free version of Java, if Oracle gets wind of that, I'm sued, and that's end of story. Yeah. But I think at that time, Unix and Bell Labs just didn't understand the amount of money that really was at hand until this whole, you know, everything started taking off more and more.
Yeah. On the flip side, there's now the movement of open hardware, which is very promising. Oh, yep. And we see things like Raspberry Pi and Arduino taking off hugely in the world. So we are now in a period, I think, of just hanging on the balance of, is the world sticking to proprietary software, or are we going in the, you know, open source route? And lots of companies, including Google and almost everybody, I think, even Apple released Swift as an open source project. So maybe now there is a kind of more leaning into what RMS has been saying all these years. Remains to be seen.
So what's the intersection of cybersecurity and open source angle then? You know, RMS seems to have taken the position that the best technology is no technology, that I'm not going to use a computer, I'm not, because it has the
backdoors.
I can't use it free. But that seems to be throwing out the baby with the bathwater a little bit, that the technology is such an incredibly useful thing. So is free software in the Libre Free, is that the answer to the cybersecurity problem? Or is that, it feels to me like that in many ways makes it worse.
Yes, I think it's not a solution. I don't think that open source software is inherently more secure than proprietary software, actually. There are bugs in almost every system. It's just a matter of how much testing and how many eyes are looking at it. And not every eye is the same eye in terms of skill and what it can do. And there are projects which are run by open source projects run by you know, people who are very, very skilled in cybersecurity, but some are not. And on the other side, you see tools, such as, for example, the Stuxnet vulnerabilities and Stuxnet mechanisms were used in open source kind of malware, even hosted on GitHub, for example. Yeah. So it's a game of both sides. It's a technology. It's always neutral. You can use it for good, you can use it for bad, and we'll see the same thing with cybersecurity, I think, in the future.
I will admit that it's probably isn't good, but anytime I've seen malware hosted on GitHub, I will try my best to write unit tests for them. So I will usually be like, hey, I've helped you to test your code. It's sound now. Like,
it's good now, yeah. Right.
I guess it's good. You're doing good somehow.
Yeah.
So in the cryptography world, open source, open algorithms particularly, have been just demonstrated that that's the only feasible way to do it. You have to have a lot of people looking at your algorithm, or else there are almost certainly holes in it. Is cybersecurity like that? That secrecy is the great enemy? That if there were no secrets, then we wouldn't have any cybersecurity problems?
It's a tough question, because one of the mantras of cybersecurity is that there's no such thing as security by obscurity. If you try to hide your vulnerabilities, they will eventually float up. But I think it's not a matter of black and white, because, for example, if you hide the internal structure of your network, for example, just obscure the internal structure of your network, a hacker who penetrates your network will have a hard time understanding where to go, where to find information. There would be a lot of, you know, systems which are irrelevant to him, but he doesn't know that yet. There's a kind of learning curve that the hacker needs to go through. So sometimes obscurity can help with defense. Not as a sole... I mean, it can never be the sole strategy for cybersecurity, but it's not a bad strategy, basically. And I think that we see in practice that open source projects, even though they do have many, many eyes on them, at least in theory, we discover vulnerabilities. And we mentioned one earlier with Linux.
Yeah.
I mean, there's hardly any other open source project that has had so many people working on it, and still you have vulnerabilities lying there for 15 years. It's there. It's very difficult to solve all of them.
Yep. Well, I think in all good conscience, we ought to not... it feels to me like we could just continue on this discussion for hours, at least from my perspective, and I would never run out of new things that I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts.
Me and you, Rob, usually go off for almost 2 hours. I mean, yeah, the two of us a really interesting third hours. Party to talk to. I'm sure we're going.
Well, and Isaac and I basically don't know anything, and so we can talk to each other for 2 hours. We get somebody who actually knows stuff. There's no limit to how long we could go on. This has been just a delightful visit, though. I have to say I very much enjoyed. I enjoy the podcast, as I said, A Malicious Life, but this has just been delightful to just be able to kind of go round and round on random topics as they came up. So thank you very much for taking time out of your sleep, I guess, to visit with us. This was a great idea. Isaac is an amazing salesman to have talked you into coming and doing this.
Well, it's much easier when we don't have to discuss JavaScript. And
that's true. Yeah, you're allowed to do whatever you want with your website.
But,
yeah.
But on behalf of all our listeners, thank you so much for doing this, Rand. And thank you so much for the time you spend doing your Malicious Life podcast, because it is so worthwhile, everything you do. So just really appreciate it. And thank you for everything.
Thank you, too. It was great fun. Thanks for all the listeners. It was great being interviewed for this podcast. And I think I should probably thank our sponsors, Malicious Life sponsors, Cyber Reason.
Absolutely.
I mean, without them underwriting the podcast, there would be no Malicious Life. So thank you, everybody. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. And so if people want to get hold of you, Rand, how would they do that?
So the Malicious Life is the website is malicious.life. And, of course, I'm on Twitter at RanLevy. That's RanLevi. And my mail, if anybody is interested, is ran@ranlevy.com.
Also, in the future, anything that you would like for us to know or promote, just let us know, Ran. We'll be more than happy talking on this podcast. Because, like me and Rob have done said 1,000 times, we've been promoting Ms. Malicious Life since day one. So just let us know.
Thank you, and I'd be happy to be on the podcast again, of course.
Oh, outstanding. So as soon as there's anything interesting happens in the cybersecurity world, we're going to drag you back over here and make you explain it all to us again.
No problem at all.
So before we leave and finish this up, I think we're going to skip right to the announcements. We'll be back in a couple of weeks, I think. And we'll clean up all of the stuff that we normally do on our episodes. So if you send in email, we did get it, and we read it, and in some cases we responded.
I did not read any email. I did not think about that till the other day. I have not checked any of the email for the show.
So if you send in email, I did get it, and I read it, and I thought about it, and I will. We'll chastise Isaac when we get off the air for being such a sluggard and not keeping track of things. And we also would like to acknowledge, first off, thanks, Rand, for being on with us. And we want to acknowledge all of the other folks who make Mintcast possible. We mention a couple of them every week. Kay Wisher for the PiCaster, which has done extra double duty tonight. It's been running this afternoon. It's been running all afternoon as we've been getting ready here. So as far as I can tell, hasn't hiccuped at all. Have to thank the folks over at Hacker Public Radio for the Mumble server that we use. We're actually using more of Mumble than we normally use. And I know Ken was on there fixing up some stuff for us, so we do very much appreciate them standing that up and helping us be able to put this all on. And, of course, the Linux Mint development team for all the fine work they do. And I am eagerly waiting for LMDE 3, and I was tinkering around this afternoon trying to figure out whether I had patched my kernel for the most recent stuff that they've fixed up there. And I don't know whether I've got it patched properly or not, but anyway. And of course, we must mention the GNU folks who in many ways have created much of the infrastructure that enabled this whole subspecies, I guess, of computers to exist. So thank you for having done all that all over the years. And I think that's going to be a wrap. What about anything else from you guys?
No, I'm just thanks for everybody in the IRC chat room. I'm just really amped that this all worked out super well.
Now, are you going to be able to sleep tonight, Isaac?
I don't know if I can. I'm probably going to like nag my wife by playing Malicious Laugh like really loud and be like, I just talked to him.
I talked to him. He's a friend of mine.
I know that guy. Cool. You know, RMS. I'll see how he's doing.
Yeah. You know. Hey, did you know that? Yeah.
I'll actually go get on the public subway here and just ride it back and forth, telling people.
Just telling people.
Just jumping on one train to the next all day long.
Yep. You'll never guess who I just talked to. Yeah. All right. All right. Well, that's going to do it for this week. So we are glad that you joined us, and I'm going to play our outro, and we're going to go home.
Yep. Take care, everyone.
This has been another episode of the Mintcast podcast. The show notes for this episode are at mintcast.org. You can send us email at mintcast@mintcast.org. You can find more information about Linux Mint at www.linuxmint.com. You can follow both Mintcast and Linux Mint on Twitter, @mintcast and @linux_mint. Thanks to Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com for our theme music, and thanks for listening to this episode of the Mintcast.